Forward Guidance is brought to you by Van Eck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about Van Eck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. Very pleased to welcome back to Forward Guidance, Andy Constant of Dampspring Advisors. Andy, great to see you. How are you?
Jack, I'm good, doing well. Good to be back.
It's great that you are back. Andy, for a long time, you have been following a script that you call the script with five different acts. Number one, where interest rates basically are high and they don't slow down the economy. Number two, where bond yields rise to new highs. Three, the higher bond yields impact the stock markets. Four, the lower stock market earnings begin to contract. And then Act 5 ends with Recession Island as equities sell off, companies fire workers. What act are we in right now and why?
We're in Act 3, where we started last July with this act when I wrote with a script when I wrote it. And we went quickly from Act 1 to Act 2 when the QRA came out in July. And then quickly to Act 3, where equities caught down to falling bond prices, and you started to see the economy weaken. It just happened at the end of Halloween. At Halloween, Janet Yellen slowed the increase in coupons. Then the Fed was dovish, and that reversed the play back to the beginning. And, you know, the end of the year, there was an expectation that the Fed was going to cut seven times in 2024. And, you know, that clearly, and the easing of financial conditions that occurred subsequent to Halloween caused the economy to come back. And so once again, we were higher for longer, and the Fed has been backpedaling on rate cuts even through till yesterday. Then in February, we had another QRA, which significantly increased the amount of coupons. And really from end of 2023 on, bonds have been going in really only one direction, which is down and higher yields on long-term bonds. So by the end of the quarter, end of the first quarter, bond yields had gone up enough, I could declare Act 3. We're in that process now where equities are catching down to falling bond prices.
So bond prices have fallen, prices down, yields up, and that is taking the legs out of the equity market. We're still within a few percent of the all-time highs. So may say that, are you bearish on the stock market now, Andy?
Yeah, right now. Bearish on bonds and stocks, frankly. I'm bullish on two-year notes, but bearish on stocks and bonds at this stage.
Bullish on the two-year note, bearish on bonds. So you think the yield curve will steepen?
I do. Mm-hmm.
You think the Federal Reserve will cut more than is priced in now? Which is funny because for a while you've been in the exact opposite. But
right. I left higher for longer island, which, you know, since you've known me, mm-hmm. I've been saying that the interest rates were priced into markets priced in cuts or not even enough hikes initially, but ultimately cuts were not going to be realized and that yields were going to be higher for longer, higher than what was priced. And that played out through now. And right now, you look at yields, and through December of 2027, the total amount of cuts expected is 125 basis points. We had 175 basis points priced in just for 2024, 4 months ago. So pricing has radically shifted on the front end. And so now there is essentially no possibility priced in for a deep recession. And so I'm no longer on higher for longer island when the pricing doesn't, when it's just gotten too rich and too crowded and you can't get a decent place.
So for a very long time, you were challenging the recessionistas that there would be no recession. So far, you've been right and they've been wrong. But it sounds like right now, based on market pricing, you think that the odds of a recession are higher than the bond market is pricing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the important thing. I'm not calling for a recession. I think there has to be a set of things that happen, which is that script I've described, that cause inflation to be killed. And in doing that, you risk a recession. But we're not having a recession today. We haven't had one for the last X number of years now. And so I'm not predicting, hey, we're about to have a recession, but the pricing already is way ahead of that. And so I think there's great opportunity to, you know, bet on the low odds that we have a recession soon for free, essentially.
Often when I've spoke to you before, Andy, you've been bearish on asset stocks and bonds. So, you know, if you're a tactical trader who's sophisticated, that means short them both. But was there a while where you were more bullish on bonds than stocks? And now you're bearish on both. Is that fair?
No, I would say that firstly, I'm nothing like a perma bear. I started soon after the COVID lows, was bullish for, I don't know, I guess all the way through early 2022. I actually overstayed my welcome a little bit, but was bullish for most of the time. And I've been bullish and calling bottoms, June of 2022, and then again in September of 2022, and notably last October on Halloween, I said you have to buy all assets.
I remember that. That was a call that that was the bottom. I remember.
Yeah,
and actually on not my show, but on this channel, Blofford's Macro, it was with my colleague and boss Mike Ippolito on the margin. Yeah,
right. And I also was on a less popular show than yours, CNBC, with that same call. But you know, since then, I've gotten bearish again, and I've gotten bearish because I think that inflation is going to be require a set of steps before it will come back to target. And so asset prices are notably higher than they were, bond prices less so. So I would describe my position as not quite as bearish bonds as I have been, but certainly not bullish, and equities quite bearish.
And I know you've posted about how, you know, this year you've been had a very good year trading for Damp Spring Advisors. And, you know, I take you at your word. I forget the exact number, but it's a very impressive number. Is it fair to say that a lot of that performance has been from shorting bonds?
Yeah, actually. So the first quarter was terrible. I think I was down 7% at my worst drawdown. I was short bonds and that helped. But I was also short stocks way too early. And so I took a nice drawdown, but April's been just phenomenally good. And that's been a combination of stocks and bonds, some gold. And so that's just been a good performance.
Nice. And then earlier you referenced the QRA quarterly refunding announcement. That is how the U.S. Treasury is funding itself by funding its deficit. Not how much, that's what Congress decides, but how much? Is it going to issue very short-term bills, or is it going to issue, what, as you said, coupons, which are longer-term? So that you said the QRA, Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury, issued more bills than was expected. That fomented this huge rally we've had. What did you make of the recent QRA that occurred this week, a few days ago in late April?
There are two schools of thought. I had one, and I think most of the street was consistent with mine, which is they told us in February they were going to maintain coupon sizes at the current coupon auctions at the current level, which would have generated a $1,084 billion gross issuance. And that's what they did. So, but there was another school of thought that said, this is a election year and, you know, the Treasury already has $800 billion in their checking account, actually closer to $1 trillion at the time in their checking account. They've spent it down to zero in the past. They're not going to issue any coupons at all practically. And they're going to spend down their Treasury general account, and which is their checking account. And that would, of course, been very bullish assets, very stimulative to the economy, et cetera. And so there was this idea of a pump, a combination of reduction of coupons and increase and spending of the Treasury general account. And, you know, that proved to be wrong. And they really delivered what was broadly expected. And so the question now becomes, when something is delivered that's at expectations, that shouldn't have a market impact. And I operate on that assumption in everything I do. So it's hard for me to argue an alternative case. If, you know, we have Apple earnings, if they meet consensus, the stock shouldn't go anywhere. If they beat, it should go up. And if they underperform, it should go down. And what's priced in is an expectation of what they do. And the reason why is people position ahead of that based on their expectations. And they either sell if they think expectations are too high or buy if they think expectations are too low. And then the news comes out and we find out. This is a situation where the market for treasuries is so large and the quantity of treasuries that we're talking about is so large that there's no set of people that will make a bet that the supply will push bond yields up or down. They just can't pre-position the news. And they can't really even pre-position the flow. Like if you know, you know, $3 billion of S&Ps are going to be bought in the last 15 minutes of the trading day, you know, and you think you're the only one that knows that, you can make money by buying 16 minutes early and selling 1 minute before the close. That's generally a solid way to make money. And so as more and more people find out that information, there's enough capital that it can mute the entire move. And so at 16 minutes prior to that flow, the price already reflects the entire amount of the flow. This one's just too big, and it has been too big. And if you look at when quantitative tightening was announced in December of 2021, and then became widely known in the minutes in January 3rd of 2022, it took 9 months. Quantitative tightening didn't even start, but it took nine. In fact, quantitative easing continued. And yet the market aggressively front ran that all the way to the lows. And then it turned out quantitative tightening wasn't quite as big as an influence as people thought. And so not surprisingly, you had a fairly major rally soon after that. And so those are huge flows, but they took 9 months. And for instance, if you were to say, hey, you know, COVID, $3 trillion of quantitative easing, $6 trillion, it turns out, of quantitative easing is being telegraphed to us. Stocks are at, I don't know, call it 2,300, 2,400, whatever the lows were. You know, we should pay 4,800 for stocks. That's not how it works. It took 2 years for us to make our high, even though that quantitative easing was going to work. It was going to push up assets. And anyone who saw it did get long, but there was just not enough ammunition to get people to get the prices rallying as much as they ended up rallying. And so I think what's happening here is we're having a slow dripping oversupply of treasuries that are going to take a long time to absorb and are going to keep a headwind on against bond price rallies. And so I would expect bond yields to rise, bond prices to fall over the course of the, you know, really, I don't see any unwind of this. Bond prices are just not that attractive as a core holding at these levels. And so I think it's going to take a meaningful price dislocation before bonds become more demand than there is supply.
And so the 10-year is about 4.6%, 4.7%. At what point would it become attractive to you? And do you think buyers will step in?
Well, I'll take you back to history. It generally is the case that the excess return for bonds over cash generates a, call it 25 basis point sharp ratio, meaning you have a certain amount of risk in the bond. It changes the changes in price, and you have an excess return over cash. And that excess return over cash has been about a 0.25 sharp ratio. And so if you think of a 10-year note as having a 6% annual price volatility, to get a sharp ratio of 0.25, you need 1.5% excess return over cash. Now, cash currently is yielding 5.33, but the path of cash for the next 10 years is not quite that high. Maybe it's 4.5. And so there's a method of extracting the excess return to cash that assets have called term premium. And so if term premiums are 150 basis points, then that should generate over time the historical return on treasuries of a 0.25 sharp ratio. Now, current term premiums are, you know, it's a made up number. It's just an estimate. But current term premiums, which were extremely negative at the end of, in the middle of winter, are now positive 25 basis points, but they still have 125 basis points more to richen before bonds become a really interesting alternative in your portfolio relative to cash. Now, they already provide some anti-growth benefit, and so diversify a stock portfolio. But as a standalone investment, by the way, I think stocks as a standalone investment don't offer that same excess return versus cash that they have. And that's partly because of the residual of a huge Fed balance sheet and tremendous QE that these term premiums are so low. Assets broadly don't offer adequate returns versus cash. And so that's why generally I'm short assets, but it matters what the policymakers do. And when term premiums were deeply negative and the Treasury decided to issue a bunch of bonds, assets cheapened a lot. And then when they decided to stop, even though they weren't cheap, assets rallied back to rich levels. And so right now we're at a level where, you know, I think, are we going to get back to the pre-quantitative easing decades where term premiums were in the 1% to 2% range? It's possible. If so, you know, assuming Fed funds are 4-ish percent, you're talking about a 5.5% 10-year note. And that's where I think we're headed.
So a term premium is basically how much you're rewarded for taking on duration risk. So now long-term bonds are not as ridiculously expensive where you have a negative term premium as 2021, for example, but they're still historically expensive. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And by the way, they were very, very rich even last summer. Mm-hmm. They had a negative 35 basis point term premium the last summer, and they had a negative 20 basis point term premium in January before the QRA. So the term premium has expanded quite a bit, and you've seen that as yields have increased.
In 2017, Forward Guidance's exclusive sponsor, VanEck, was the first ETF issuer to file for a Bitcoin-linked ETF. 7 years later, Bitcoin ETFs are finally available. Using the VanEck Bitcoin Trust ticker HODL, you can invest in Bitcoin with zero fees until March 31st, 2025. That's right, zero fees until March 31st, 2025. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today or visit vaneck.com/HODLFG to learn more. Now, the disclosures. An investment in the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL, involves significant risk and may not be suitable for all investors. You could lose your entire investment. The Trust offers fewer investor protections as it is not registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940 or as a commodity pool under the Commodity Exchange Act. For a complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus link below. You can learn more about HODL and its zero fees until March 31st, 2025 at vaneck.com/HODLFG. That's vaneck.com/HODLFG. And now back to the interview. So far, we've talked almost exclusively about the plumbing, not just Federal Reserve, quantitative easing, quantitative tightening, but specifically the Treasury, how much duration they're putting out into the market when they issue. When you trade the S&P 500 futures, let's say, you're trading not just on that. You're trading on expectations of growth and inflation. You're trading on Apple earnings. How do you sort of trade on something that trades on so many different factors? Do you have to focus on everything? In other words, you know, how do you sort of find your edge? Because if I only trade Apple, all that matters is Apple earnings, right? For example, today. But there's so many things that impact the S&P. How do you, for example, know, okay, I have a view about X and X is going to impact the stock market in Y direction. However, there's A through W is also going to affect it. How do you sort of refine that?
Well, I mean, I think the most important thing is that you just have to start with knowing what A through Z is, what drives prices, what drives the asset you're talking about. And then you have to diversify so that you aren't betting on only a single one of those things when you need to bet on all of them. You diversify by having some alternative. And so I never, ever have a single asset in my portfolio. I would never make a bet that's that concentrated. My bets tend to have a bunch of things going on that tend to say, well, what's the environment I'm betting on as a macro investor? And for instance, right now, as I said, I'm short long-term bonds and long two-year bonds and short stocks. That portfolio is more diversified. And so I'm not just betting on being short stock. If they cut interest rates, I'm going to be in trouble because they're going to rally. And so right now, as I mentioned, two-year notes offer almost free bet that the Fed's going to cut interest rates. And so I can put on two-year notes long and benefit when there is a, when the Fed cuts interest rates. And so I've constructed a portfolio that does that. That's the objective in trading macro. It's not making a single bet. But to be honest, that's part of the risk. You know, if you can't diversify away all of your risk, and so you have to expect risk that could go either way. And so let's say I had a 70% chance, which is too high, 70% chance that my X and Y and Z factors were going to generate a positive P&L for me. Okay, that sounds like a bet. Now, if this is really A through X, A through V, A through V of other risks, the question is, do I have any edge on those? And let's assume I don't. And so then the question becomes, does anybody? Because if nobody has any edge, then A through V are just random. They create risk, but they don't create negative alpha. And so that still may be an interesting bet if you have a 70% chance on three variables and a coin flip on 23 variables. Okay, what does that add up to? Is that a 52% bet? That may be worth taking. And so the question is, when you look at what price is stocks and you try to break that down, you say, okay, A is bullish, B is bearish, Z is one that I have an edge on and it's bearish, and X and Y are the same and they're bearish. But, you know, I add up all these things and I have indicators on whatever I can and a bunch of things I don't know. And then you have to assume, what's the odds that you're wrong or right on things you don't know anything about? And the answer is, it's decent assumption that it's just random. And so all it creates is your variance. It doesn't create your, it doesn't have a negative or positive expected value.
And a lot of what you said hinges on correlation between other assets. I own bonds and they're going to be a hedge against stocks. How do you manage the fact that these correlations change? And, you know, the VIX will almost always go up when stocks have a sharp sell-off, almost always. You know, obviously there are exceptions. But when you look at, for example, the correlation between stocks and bonds, a very common narrative is, oh, the market can't handle, you know, interest rates at 5%. But how do you handle the fact that these correlations change? You know, for example, Act 3, multiple compression, higher yields take the legs out of the equity market. And that is the same thing, that higher bond yields will make the future cash flows of the stock market worth less. And sometimes that definitely works, like in 2022, as interest rates shot up, the market sold off. But sometimes they have a different correlation where, you know, in March 2020, interest rates were collapsing and the stock market crashed alongside that. Likewise, you know, over the past 6 months, interest rates have risen or bond yields have risen alongside the stock market. So, I mean, are you just tracking these correlations, you know, every single day? As well as a more specific question, what have you made of the fact that the market has risen alongside yields, i.e. stocks go up as bonds go down?
Right. I think that's a good place to start with that on that question, which is the way I do it, and anybody can do it however way they want. The way I do it is I think about what the drivers are. And for instance, in an environment where, well, the economy, the nominal GDP, the real GDP, earnings are rising, you would expect stocks and bonds to bond yields to go up because growth is rising. And you would expect stocks to go up because earnings are going up. And there's a discount rate issue there, which is generating a negative correlation. And there's a earnings stream that's generating a positive correlation between yields and stock prices. And the question is, how how important is it, and which one do you weight more? And then there's this third thing, which is, well, what's term premium doing? And so what I would say in the case that we're describing, you have earnings expectations, bullish stocks. You have, until recently, term premiums bullish both, because term premiums were contracting, bullish both. And you have growth and inflation, bearish bonds. For stocks, you have growth, bullish stocks, and inflation, it depends. It depends on whether the inflation is top line, allowing companies to raise prices without experiencing significant cost increases, meaning wages aren't going up, or the opposite, where they're unable to now increase prices, but wages are increasing and that's squeezing margin. So what I've just done there is just broken down the drivers of all these things. And that helps you have an edge if you have a way of judging what growth expectations are going to do, the inflation expectations, and term premium expectations. That helps. And then there's positioning, which is, you know, the last of my framework. But I think your question goes to a different thing, which is, we don't know how these things are going to play out. We don't know how the correlations are going to go. And that's a risk management tool decision. That's not a bet. That's saying, we have an uncertain outcome, which could cause correlations to go in whatever way they go. How does one position one? But you have a view that has expected return on it. How risky is that view depends on how volatile the correlations are. And how you then size it depends on your risk management. So I happen to have a risk management strategy. I've published it on my Twitter account many times, but you know, I'm unwilling to take meaningful tail risk. I'm willing to take a drawdown, but I'm not willing to take an unlimited drawdown. And so that is one of the reasons I get comfortable doing trades that may have volatile correlations.
What is your view on the correlation between stocks and bonds going forward? It sounds like you think interest rates, bond yields will go up, and you're bearish stocks. Do you think the correlation will flip? And at some point, the high bond yields will be a drag on the markets.
Well, I think they have been lately. Mm-hmm. Certainly the month of April, you've seen stocks peak, and now they're selling off. Are they selling off a lot? I don't know. It depends on where you look. There seem to be selling off, and bond yields seem to be rising. And so that's what's happening. I think what's happening is term premium expansion because of a variety of things, but mostly the supply is my principal view of that. And in that case, you would expect the correlations that are occurring now, which is rising bond yields and falling stock prices. My outlook is for this more of the same, where bond yields rise and stocks fall. That's what my outlook is. That's the bet I'm making. And so I'm expecting those correlations, which is a positive correlation for prices, bonds and stocks both going down at the same time. You know, that's where I'm at. I might be wrong, of course, but you know, that's my expectation because I think the driver is those. Now, if I thought the driver was growth, we've had some pretty solid growth. If growth were to stop accelerating and start heading down, well, that would be good for bonds, but it would be particularly good for two-year notes and okay, good, but not great for 10-year bonds. But it would really be bad for stocks because the growth is what's something that stocks are directly correlated with. And so if you had a view that we've peaked in terms of nominal growth, bond yields, long-term bond yields have pressure from supply. And as we enter into a slower growth, a little growth slowdown, I'm not talking about a depression or a recession. I'm just talking about a little growth slowdown. You would expect earnings to slow. You would expect, which would be bad for stocks. You'd expect the supply causing yields, long-term yields to stay high, which is bad for the discounting of stocks. But you'd also see inflation coming in, which may allow the Fed to cut, which will help two-year bonds a lot, but not necessarily help stocks, but could hold stocks up. And so when you play those sort of situations out, that's the bet you make. And right now, that's the bet I'm looking at, which is expanding term premiums, slowing growth, sticky inflation.
That scenario, you imagine a growth slowdown. Would that be a slowdown in nominal growth or in real growth?
Well, it's mostly real growth, but because I do think inflation's going to be sticky, but nominal growth will slow too by the component that's real.
Got it. So yesterday, Powell, a journalist, asked a question, but you had some pushback against journalists. You said some of the questions were a little bit moronic. What did you mean by that?
It's tough to be the Fed chair. 4 months ago when inflation data was cold and they said, well, we're not going to cut right now, he got destroyed by, the questions are, well, what evidence do you need to cut? Look at all this. It's obvious that you should cut. Apparently, and he did nothing. And so did nothing for like 3-4 meetings, right? And so this meeting, he said, we're not going to change rates and, we're data dependent and we may cut. And they said, cut? Why wouldn't you hike? Look at all this data. My observation is that reporters are would like the Fed to say something that they could then say, this was the mistake. We asked him why he wasn't hiking. And look, we knew and he didn't. They're always playing that gotcha game. And it was just more of the same yesterday.
And Powell remarked that he thought it was unlikely that the next move would be a hike instead of a cut, somewhat taking hikes off the table. Did you ever seriously think that there would be, there would be further hikes after the Fed indicated that the next move would be an easing stance and it did three cuts in the dot plot?
I put a list together that's reminiscent of what Byron Wien did at the end of the year, where he would predict a bunch of things that are priced very unlikely, but may happen. And the one I picked was one of the 10 I picked was that the Fed was going to hike more than it cut in 2024. I'm still there. I think there's the smallest of small chance that they do anything at all. I think the odds are that they'll won't do anything in 2024, unless, of course, my script plays out, and then they'll start cutting. But I'm not sure my script will play out. I'm not sure the supply of bonds will necessarily keep long-term interest rates high. And if they don't, and long-term interest rates fall and the stock market makes new highs, the Fed's going to hike. It's going to have to, because the economy is going to heat up. So I think there's a lot of possibilities right now. When I made that claim was in December, and there were 7 cuts priced in. So I feel a little better about that guess. But right now it's a toss-up whether they hike or cut. Probably won't hike. Probably won't cut.
Probably won't cut. And yet you were bullish on two-year notes.
They got to cut one day. Mm-hmm. By the way, it's important to notice, there's only one cut priced into after today, there's almost two, but 1.5 cuts priced into year end. So it's betting on 2 years is betting on only 100 basis points for the whole for 13 meetings. If you buy 2-year notes right now, the Fed has to not cut over 13 meetings. That seems like a lot to me. Particularly if they want to kill, if they expect inflation to end, because if they expect inflation to end and they're right, regardless of the script that inflation just magically ends up at target, they're going to cut. And so to me, there's more downside than that. So I like 2-year notes, but if you put a gun to my head, I would say that they're not going to cut
this year.
I mean, but again, now you're asking me to pick a side of a coin. It's like the odds are right now it's 50-50. So if you ask me which way the coin's going to flip, I'm going to say not cut. But it's not a good bet.
So, but you said 50-50. That's your perception of...
No, that's what's priced in options markets.
The options market are pricing a 50% chance that the Fed doesn't cut at all?
Yeah, versus cut one or two times, yeah. I mean, if you use options, if you use the Fed tool, it doesn't work. But
yeah, okay. So I know that much superior and much, you know, more accurate way is using options. I don't have that level of skills, but so this, yeah, the CME Fed Funds Probability Calculator, I know it's flawed, but I still look at it, of course.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it gives you some information. It just doesn't give you accurate odds past a period of time when there is a hike or cut priced. Unfortunately, what a guy I've been following for a long time seems to have disappeared off Twitter, but he would regularly post that distribution for all of us to see. I do it myself, but it's very nice that he was doing that and that made it so easy to see. So hopefully somebody picks up that story.
Oh, I think I know who you're referring to. And if he is off Twitter, I'm actually very sad.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't really look at options pricing on Fed funds or SOFR stuff at all. Tell me about that space. I know in the equity market, almost all the time there is put skew. So higher implied volatility for out of the money puts than calls, because the market tends to elevator down, stairs up. What about in the interest rate world? What is the various skews? What are the expensive options? What is the options market pricing in?
So what it is saying that if you use the Fed tracker tool, you're going to get a probability of cuts and hikes over the course of many meetings that is going to use the spot level of the futures curve to determine that distribution.
Can I explain what I think you meant? Because I think so. Even people will be confused by that. So let's say if the December, I'm just making it up, December 2024 is 94.5, that's implying a rate of 5.5. The CME Fed funds probability is going to calculate a symmetrical bell curve distribution around that, whereas options will...
I wish they did.
Okay. Oh, so they don't.
They don't even do that, but I don't want to get into the weeds on that. But the options market will price a implied distribution. What is an implied distribution? All of us who have taken statistics or traded options or whatever know about log normal distributions, and they look like the classic bell curve. If that were true, that was the distribution of future prices, options skew, meaning different implied volatilities, would be an arbitrage, meaning there could only be one distribution of prices. And if you guarantee me that it is a normal distribution of prices, I can tell you that skew is provides an arbitrage, because the idea is that the distribution would look not like that if you took the prices and implied a distribution instead of setting a volatility that has a normal distribution. So by using option prices, you can get what is called an implied distribution. And that implied distribution is not, when there is skew in options market, is not normal. It has different characteristics. And so, when you do that, you can then figure out what the probability of a cut is and a hike is more accurately. And so that's what we do with that stuff. It's old technology. I remember doing it in the 90s. But implied distributions are a standard toolkit for most. The CME just can't do that. It's just...
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had a Bloomberg terminal in 2.5 years, but I think even them, I mean, WIRP, they're not doing what that guy...
Yeah, work doesn't work either.
Yeah, exactly. You got to do it yourself, yeah.
So anyway, the point is there's been changes in that distribution. And I imagine that, I haven't looked today, but I imagine that potential for a hike has dropped given what Powell said. I do think he took it off the table for the time being. But, you get a hot CPI number, it goes back on the table.
What would it take for you to be bullish on stocks?
So there's some good reasons and some bad reasons. The good reasons would be price. An expectation that earnings were going to be stronger than expected, which would be a combination of very strong productivity, which could be things like AI. So lots of reasons why I could be convinced that earnings are going to be better than expectations. Now, they're very high already, so it would take a lot. But I guess I could be convinced that earnings are going to be far in excess of expectations. Now, what would do that the best would be a very strong economy. And that's why I think about bonds, which is for me to get bullish on stocks, I have to be bearish on bonds. The other thing is price. Obviously, if I'd love to buy some stocks at 16 multiples, but they're not offered there. So lower price would certainly do it. And then I guess the last thing is, and maybe we're getting this, I don't know. Some people say we are. I don't personally believe them. But if you think that the Fed is going to change its inflation target, and let the economy run hot, you can't own bonds. Those you just cannot own. But you certainly can own gold and crypto and stocks, because they're going to do well if you if the economy is let to run hot. And so there was a period of time in late March, I think, where I flipped and said, you know what? Central banks may have given up on inflation. Their actions appear to be inconsistent with what, the way I see the economic data evolving, and that indicates they may have given up. And I overweighted in my beta portfolio, I overweighted equities and commodities and gold, and underweighted nominal bonds. And the last month has helped me out get back out of that position and into a position that's more balanced. But yeah, I'm all in on equities if the central banks give up on inflation.
And all in on equities over bonds.
Well, I'm short bonds as much as I could possibly be in a world in which inflation, the inflation mandate is given up on.
What do you make of gold, which after doing nothing to for the gold bugs for a very long time, has now finally shot up? It's trading as if the Fed now have abandoned their inflation.
Well, I think what's happening is other countries have, or not even abandoned. They're trying to manufacture inflation. And so if you look at Asia in particular, Japan and China, you can see that those countries are trying to reduce real interest rates in a meaningful way by allowing inflation to run hot. In Japan, for instance, even though they're raising rates, they're still essentially getting real, offsetting real rates going lower. And that's good for gold in yen. And certainly the Chinese are trying to, as carefully as possible, but and slowly and deliberately, are trying to get the economy back on its feet. And, you know, that's trying to get real interest rates lower, and that's good for gold and yuan. And when things are happening that are good for gold and yuan and good for gold and yen, people buy gold, and that makes it good for gold and dollars. And so to me, the dollar rally in gold is not that interesting. The dollar rally in gold is caused by the yen rally in gold and the yuan rally in gold. And then there's this other idea, and I'm not sure how much credence to play with in it, which is this reserve balance and the central banks buying gold to due to potential weaponization of the U.S. dollar, which we saw with Russia. And there's also a period of time when gold sort of started to take off as various enemies of the United States may have thought, let's get out of U.S. dollar assets and flee to gold during the, you know, the since October in the Middle East. But, you know, the disconnect between real rates in the U.S. and gold prices is pretty significant. And so right now I'm short, and I shorted around 2420 and intend to hold it to 2100. But I love gold. I think gold provides certain things in portfolios that no other asset can. Crypto more so lately, but no other real asset can. And so, you know, I'm renting a short position in gold, and I'm expect to cover it and go long again.
You're renting the short in gold because with how high real interest rates are, gold should be lower, but it's not.
Yeah. And also what I've also noticed is that these pressures on the yen to weaken are being offset now. The pressures on the yuan are still significant. But the flows into gold seem to be slowing. Like the buying that was associated with that has slowed. And there's also some changes in lately, very late, recently, there's been some changes in margining of owning gold. And that has taken some of the legs out of the gold rally. So, you know, it's a trade.
It's a trade. What do you think? You said the Japanese, talked about the Japanese yen, which had been depreciating extremely quickly against the U.S. dollar. And that's part of the reason why gold in yen terms has done so well. Do you think that the Japanese Ministry of Finance is targeting a certain level and defending the yen to stop its further depreciation?
So my strongest feeling has been, and this has been one of my core views for a while now, I don't remember how long, but it feels like forever, that the yen needs to go lower do the necessary stimulative impact on inflation in Japan and get that economy on its feet. How far that has to go, that's a different question. But my view is that they haven't gone far enough. And in order to maintain the progress they've made, they are likely to need a yen that's continued to go lower, not radically lower, but continue to depreciate. And so then the question is, why are they intervening, which they are doing? And they did during the Golden Week holiday, which is typical when markets are illiquid, for maximum impact. And they've appeared to have done it twice, though it's not confirmed yet, the second time today, after doing it on Sunday. I think it was Sunday. I expect them to, what they're doing there is they also think that the yen needs to go down, but they don't like it to go down fast, and they like to burn the speculators. Mm-hmm. And so I think they did that. And I think they, when will they end? Hopefully the day after I sell some to them. But as of yet, I haven't done any positioning in that.
And do you have a view on interest rates in Japan, which are, I mean, they must be the lowest in the world. The 10-year yield in Japan, it's up, you know, from negative, it's now at 0.9%, but that's, you know, well below any other 10-year bond that I know.
I don't. I think the pressures on global interest rates are going to emanate from the United States and are going to impact the globe. You know, when you look at swapping U.S. treasuries through all of the hedging mechanisms necessary to get it to literally be like a U.S. treasury fully priced in yen, it's not like you get a bargain in the United States. When you do all that hedging, you end up with basically the same yield as you've got in Japan. And so I don't think that rate is particularly interesting, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's probably going to rise a little bit.
And you said that the interest rate pressure is coming from the United States. Why is that?
That's the supply. Mm-hmm. We're the only country that stimulated as much, issued as many T-bills that now need to be refinanced, did as extensive QE. And so we're going to have to issue a lot of bonds. Other countries have shown more fiscal restraint. Europe by sort of mandate, and that they can't really do much with unbalanced budgets, and Japan and China, which didn't really stimulate. So we've got the debt to refinance, and we're going to have the biggest impact.
Do you have a view on the Chinese stock market, which kind of snuck out of nowhere, is now outperforming the NASDAQ year to date? Nowhere close to its all-time highs, of course. But have a view there?
I wrote a DSR, which I put out on my Damp Spring Report, which I put out on my Twitter account called The Year of the Dragon. And one of my Byron Wien things was that the Asian stock market, the Chinese stock market, was going to outperform the NASDAQ, and looked pretty bad for a while. But I think it's very difficult to invest in China. And but at the same time, I think the point of the Year of the Dragon Damp Spring Report was to really describe how out of favor it had become, and really a classic contra position. How far it goes, you know, they can choose to have it fall 10% tomorrow. I've gotten out of that position, but I am looking to get back in.
And final question for you, Andy, what did you make of the Federal Reserve's announcement that starting in June, it is going to taper its quantitative tightening. So instead of letting a maximum of $60 billion of treasuries roll off, it's now going to do $25
billion. Yeah, that was inevitable, something I predicted in my last Damp Spring report. I thought it was possible they wait till June to decide, but thought of, 30% chance, pretty decent coin flip chance they go today. They went a little bigger than I expected. I expected $30 billion. They did $35 billion of tapering. And so I think it was fairly widely expected because, so the implication of that is that the Treasury is going to be able to issue less to pay the Fed back than they had otherwise issued. And we know they're not changing the amount of coupons because they've announced what those will be. And so those will still weigh on those who buy coupons. But what they will do is they will issue fewer bills. And fewer bills means that some of the money that would have bought that is going to end up staying in the RRP, and that's going to give a buffer for banks and others to, that need financing in sort of more stressful periods. This was all about the Fed trying to continue to reduce the balance sheet such that reserves end up around $3 trillion, maybe a little lower in the banking system. You know, we still have $750 billion to go, which should have meant QT for another full year. But tapering now and doing it for 18 months instead of not tapering and doing it for a year, I don't see a big difference.
And so you don't think that this tapering changes the ultimate level of the size of the Fed's reserve balance sheet? In other words, you take Powell at his word when he said, this is changing the speed, but not the destination.
Who the hell knows? I mean, the one thing that I would say is when they taper QT, the next question is, when are you going to stop? Mm-hmm. So, if they thought they might not stop, they might not have tapered. So you have to increase the conditional probability in some sense that stopping is the next destination. But I don't see any need for it. The RRP will end up, they're concerned about the RRP heading towards zero. The RRP will be supported by this action. And they have time. The thing that bothers me most, and I'll rant a bit, the thing that bothers me most about the whole policy is if they had just done quantitative tightening like the BOE, and the way they do it is they actually sell bonds in marketplace instead of allowing their bonds to mature and have the Treasury then decide the impact of quantitative tightening. If they had just sold bonds to begin with, particularly if they had sold mortgages, yeah, they would have cooled the inflation off quickly. And that would have been a much more sensible outcome. And I've been calling for that for as long as I can remember. As long as they mentioned quantitative tightening, I've been saying, do more. So it's curious to me why they're doing less. They should do more. And they should cut short-term interest rates because they don't need to be this high. What they need to do is make long-term interest rates high, and that's what slows the economy. And for whatever reason, they seem unwilling to accept that. They think it's their principal lever is what drives the economy. And many people now recognize that with long-term interest rates locked in by a lot of participants and an economy that is much more services-oriented than goods-oriented, and longer-term debt levels and other wealth measures like stock prices have a bigger impact than the short-term interest rate that the Fed seems to want to twist.
Right. So many U.S. homeowners and corporations locked in those low rates of 2020 and 2021. Andy, it's been great getting to hear your views. People can find you on Twitter at Damp Spring, where you are very active. And your Damp Spring work is at dampspring.com. You also work alongside Nick G, who I'll be interviewing in a few weeks at Two Gray Beards. Can you tell people the difference between Damp Spring and Two Gray Beards and the how that it's a different product?
Sure. Two Gray Beards is really designed for people who have 20 minutes a week to think about their investments. So someone who has a financial advisor who they speak to from once a year to once a month, and every time they talk to them, they don't know what the hell they're saying. And so can't ask good questions about their allocation, don't know if their financial advisor knows what they're talking about. with 20 minutes a week, watching a video that Nick and I distill what's going on and what matters and what to do about it in the portfolio we manage. That's what Two Gray Beards is about, is to help you have better conversations with your financial advisor. Damp Spring offers a long-only focus too, but our principal focus at Damp Spring is providing hedge funds and large institutions with high-quality macro research and strategy. And our Twitter product, DS Read, is designed to have you have a look at that. And, you know, at the same time that I provide my hedge fund clients with information and research, I provide you with that same stuff. And we can discuss it, and you can benefit from or challenge me if you think I'm wrong, and do it in a very high-touch way. It's really designed for people who really want to improve their understanding of investing broadly and alpha generation in particular in a very active way. So someone who has committed, is willing to commit a lot of time to that effort.
Yes. And your trading process, as I understand it, is trading. I mean, you are an investor, but you're a trader and you get in and out of things. So if someone listened to, oh, but at the last podcast, he said this, that wasn't your long-term view. You probably changed your mind, you know, a few weeks after that.
I usually have a month to 3 month view. Neither product is twitchy day trading stuff.
Yeah, it's not twitchy day trading stuff, but you do change your mind, which Absolutely. Is a good thing. Andy, thanks so much for coming on, and thanks everyone for watching.
Pleasure.
Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vanek.com/hodlfg to learn more about the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL.